Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, a bold initiative to reclaim South Africa's knights from crime. Inside, the radical shift set to redefine the workplace, pay and power in 2026. South Africa's green energy revolution faces a critical skills crisis that could choke its potential. And South Africa's 9 billion rand toy market is booming, proving that joy still matters even in tough times. It's Friday, the 14th of November. The workplace is changing faster than ever with something called moonshot pay, AI-driven incentives, self-managed teams, all reshaping how we work and get rewarded. Now, speaking at the recent South African Reward Association conference, well-known remuneration expert Dr. Mark Buesen said 2026 is going to be a defining year for how companies attract, motivate and keep talent. And he warned that while emotionally intelligent leadership and entrepreneurship are on the rise, AI-driven job cuts and a widening skills gap could leave many people behind. So let's talk to Mark now about what these shifts mean for leaders and for anyone who is trying to stay relevant in the year or years ahead. So Mark, welcome. You paint both an inspiring and I also think an unsettling picture of what next year is going to look like. You've listed a number of trends. Which of those pose the biggest threat, in your opinion, to South African employment and leadership stability?
Thank you, Jeremy, and thanks for having me. Look, I think it's jobs. And we're all guessing whether AI is going to be creating more jobs, and people say it's job neutral because you need technicians and computer programmers to program all of this and skilled people to monitor it. But that is not my take on the situation. I think there's going to be a bloodbath, a jobs bloodbath internationally and globally. And we need to think about how we are going to create more jobs. I think it'll be on the radar of every single country, not just in Africa, but around the world.
What type of jobs are we talking about here?
So the first thing is to make laws easier so that entrepreneurs can create their own work and start their own companies. We have sometimes have to pay VAT before we even get our first invoice paid ourselves. So you need a lot of money to start a business. We need to make it's very easy to start businesses. So that's the first one. The job bloodbath is anything that AI can do, teaching, university professors, legal guys who are just looking up precedent, case precedents, everywhere there's going to be job loss. So I think governments need to come to the party here and say, look, if you start a new business, you've got a tax break for 3 or 6 months or whatever the case is. Labor laws, yes, they're very important. We need them to protect employees. But when you start your business, you might recruit the wrong person. You know, can you release them? And big business is not hiring. So in the United States, what some of the big businesses are doing is if you come up with a really good idea, they'll give you $5,000 to $20,000, depending. If you go out there, create employment for between 10, 15, 20, 30 people. And why would you do that? Because you're creating ambassadors. So we really need to start thinking out the box on how to create jobs.
Let's, if we have time, return to artificial intelligence. But you also referred to moonshot pay. My understanding is that executives taking big risks for long-term rewards. Mark, in a country with extreme inequality, isn't this trend tone-deaf or even dangerous?
It could well be. But trends are catchy and trends cross oceans. So it's starting to happen in Europe. It's starting to happen in the US, where CEOs initially are saying, look, I don't care about job descriptions. I don't care about job evaluation. I don't care about your pay scales. I don't care about short-term incentives, long-term incentives. None of that matters to me. Give me $50 million if I hit 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And that's what's called moonshot pay. So there are a lot of attractive things about it. What we're quibbling about, I think, is the quantum of pay. But folk at the moment are earning those quantums anyway. So what we're doing away with is the bureaucracy, the red tape, sometimes some of the laws that apply. And we are just about to promulgate Section 30A and 30B of the Companies Act, which means, Remuneration Committee members need to stand down after two no votes. So there's increasing legislation in Africa versus globally. They're trying to decrease legislation. They're trying to make it easier for you to do business. The stock exchange is another example. 20, 30 years ago, there were double the number of companies on the stock exchange. I'm not saying the only reason they're delisting is that the rules are cumbersome, but it's one of them. So we need to make things a lot easier.
Mark, I don't know if this question is related to the moonshot question, but you also predict the removal of toxic leaders that's going to gain traction even in smaller firms. But realistically, how many South African businesses are brave enough to prioritize, I wonder, emotional intelligence over those short-term results that you were talking about?
Unfortunately, not enough. But in the circles that I mix in, more and more boards and more legislators are coming on board with the fact that it's not okay to have toxic leadership. It destroys the employee value proposition. People go to work with a knot in their stomach, and one shouldn't have to do that. I heard an interview on the radio this morning where a board member of one of the state-owned entities was saying, we've had enough of the corruption, we've had enough of toxic leadership, and the answer is no. So it's coming. I think it's coming, and that's some of the good news. So I think we have started to turn the corner on toxic leaders. The highest performing companies in the world do not allow toxic leadership in the top 300 of their structures. It's just not good enough to be an excellent actuary or engineer or accountant and destroy the people value proposition and destroy the culture by being a toxic leader. No, we'll move you to the side. You can be an individual contributor. You can not manage any people and you can still contribute, but in a different way. So maybe it's not firing them, but it could be contributing in a different way. Yeah, but you won't lead our people.
Yeah. No parking space and an office in the basement. You also mentioned something called conscious unbossing, and this pertains to younger employees. What's that?
So, very, very interesting concept where I lecture a lot in Europe, the Middle East, in Asia, and more and more folk are talking about conscious unbossing. And it only really hit me when I was standing on the side of the rugby field. I've got a 13-year-old son, and he plays in the C team rugby. And they had to decide whether to take the penalty kick, whether to run it, whether to do this or that. And I couldn't work out who was making the decisions. So I asked the young James, who's the captain of your team? And he looked at me blankly and he said, we don't have one. So I said, who decides whether you're going to kick or run or do this or take a penalty? And he says, we all do. And then I spoke to him about it. And he's a lovely child, a clean heart. There's no reason for him to mislead me. I try to hear from him how they all are the captain and all run that team and how they all make decisions. And I put that story together with what's happening globally. And it's true. Folk are coming in. They don't want a boss. They do want guidelines. They do want leadership, but they don't want bossy bosses. And we need to unlearn plock, plan, lead, organize, and control. And we need to develop inspirational leaders, and I'll follow you.
Mark, I understand the analogy as far as the teenage rugby team is concerned, but surely in a big organization, that's just a recipe for chaos.
It could well be, but that's where you have policies and procedures in place and you have leaders that inspire. So it's to be tested. I can't wait to see the next 10, 15 years if that prediction comes true, but I think it will.
Always enjoy talking to you about those trends. Dr. Mark Buesen, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
It's been widely reported that South Africa stands at the threshold of a massive energy transition, one that could reshape our economy. It could create thousands of jobs and position the country as a global leader. I'm talking about green hydrogen. But there is a problem, the age-old shortage of skills that maybe could even stop this revolution before it starts. And the issue is taking center stage at the Mapungubwe Institute for Strategic Reflections Platinum Group Metals Roundtable. Policymakers, academics, and industry leaders have been gathering to map out a solution. So let's talk about this in a little more detail. Zamanzima Mazibuko Makana is with us, who is a researcher at the Institute. this, and welcome to you. This is an important issue. You've described South Africa's green hydrogen potential as enormous, but that skills gap is existential. How severe is the shortage, and what type of skills are we specifically talking about?
Thanks for having me, Jeremy. Yes, it is a major problem. So with hydrogen, there are various aspects. The value chain is quite large. We need skills from people like engineers. We need green artisans. We need technicians. So right now, with what we have a large gap. And when we look at what is even offered in terms of the skills and the training, we don't have the right expertise. We don't have the type of a niche technological capabilities that are required for a hydrogen economy.
Why do you think South Africa has been so slow to develop this kind of talent pipeline then, despite years of energy policy discussion? It's not a new issue and it's not a new problem.
No, it's not new at all. I think we just don't have that anticipatory and agile approach to these things. Our curriculum should have already had these skills embedded in the programs, because as you say, it's not a new thing. Countries like Germany and Japan have way advanced green hydrogen economies. So with us, we lag behind. I think, to be fair, even the types of investments that are required are large, but in the long run, it becomes more affordable. So we need to commit to making the investment upfront, so that by the time we have this economy, it's actually much cheaper to run. Mm.
I want to get back to curricula in just a moment, but you're suggesting to me that the skills gap is severe. Do you think it could or is already derailing projects that are in the pipeline?
Well, in South Africa, the projects are still pretty new, so we're still okay. We still have the time to actually upskill our workforce, and we need to move fast in order to meet the demand when the time comes. So right now, it's still being developed, it's still being built. As I said, we still have the time to actually ensure that we have a workforce that is ready to take up the opportunity.
But I'm sensing we're not moving fast enough in that respect.
No, we're not. We're not moving fast enough because, yes, so there are people that are being trained, like chemical engineers and such, that may be able to work through this economy, but they don't have that niche type of skills that the hydrogen economy requires. And this is where then we need the higher education institutions to come to play with us here.
So let's go back to the curricula then. This mismatch that you referred to between what universities are teaching and what the industry needs. What kind of competencies are either missing or outdated in the current engineering and science degrees, do you think?
It's the hydrogen-specific ones. So they do have like general types of skills that are required for chemical engineers, for example. But the hydrogen-specific ones that will enable these engineers to handle hydrogen, because it is highly flammable and can be very dangerous to work with. So you need these engineers to be able to know how to handle hydrogen safely and such. So those type of specific skills that are required are still missing.
And if we fail then to build that local expertise, I'm assuming that we would become more dependent on imported skills. That then poses high risk to sovereignty, to job creation and technology transfer. Again, that clock is ticking.
Definitely, because if we then rely on the imported talent, it means then we don't actually benefit from all the jobs that are being created by this economy. It's important for us to look at this as an opportunity for localization and for social development. So we need to benefit. Our communities need to be highly involved in this development of this economy, and us relying extensively on important skills will be detrimental to our own economy.
Curriculum is one thing, but it's also surely an issue around government policy. And this Hydrogen Valley Initiative is interesting, it's ambitious. But I think we've got to ask whether the Department of Higher Education and even the Department of Science, and I think it's Science and Innovation, are aligned enough to deliver the kind of workforce that you're talking to me about.
Yes, so we need them to actually work together. We need this sort of like co-creation of the curriculum, including with industry. But from the government, we need to ensure that they come to play. They create an enabling environment for the growth of the green economy. They need to ensure that there is localization, there's workforce inclusion, as well as social participation. So they need to work hand in hand. And even going back to high school education, where we need to encourage our learners to actually take up science, technology, engineering, and math subjects and actually enjoy them. And that also speaks to how teaching happens, where, currently, for example, math is seen as such a scary subject. Everyone is just, trying to avoid it. But it actually, we need these subjects in order to build that economy, because it's the backbone of the economy, of the green hydrogen economy.
Such a lot of potential, but so much work to do. From Mistra, thank you very much indeed. Zamanzima Mazibuko Makena, I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, among others, the South African Police Service, Fire and Rescue Operations, Sandparks, and Bidvest Protea Coin have officially signed a joint memorandum of understanding committed to tightening collaboration during the country's most dangerous hours between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. It's called Operation Night Watch, and it aims to strengthen coordination, training, and equipment standards across law enforcement and private security, all, I guess, to better protect South Africans after dark. I want to talk now to Werner van der Westhuizen, director at the tactical torch manufacturer NextTorch, about this initiative. He is part of it. And let's discuss what it means on the ground. So, Werner, this collaboration is formally in place now. Maybe start off by telling me what the driving force was behind Operation Nightwatch.
Yeah, I think it's sort of a rather clear objective. Crime in South Africa is rampant. There's not a huge decrease in crime at the moment, especially when it comes up to like the festive season at the moment, like we have now. So we're seeing huge spikes in crime all over the country, and something like this is all the different security companies. They work in the same areas, but most of them don't have communication with each other in the same areas. Some of them get into situations where they actually need support and backup from other security companies and SAPS and other law enforcement entities in the same areas. So the idea with this was to not only get them better equipment and gear that they can use, but to actually strengthen the relationship and open communication channels between the different security companies. So just to obviously increase the safety of the actual law enforcement officers, but also allow them to execute their duties, more proficiently. And so we started talking to the different security companies that we actually work with. And, everybody's on the same page that, the only way to combat the absolute tidal wave of crime at the moment is to work together.
Werner, on paper, it looks like a brilliant idea. I'm sure it will be welcomed. But I would also suggest to you that collaboration often between public and private, the public and private security companies hasn't always been smooth. Your challenge, all the parties' challenge, will to make sure that the agreement works to ensure accountability and that information sharing. How are you going to do that on the ground?
I think, in practice, SAPS is inundated with calls. They don't have the manpower to actually get to everything, and that's nothing new. So the idea is, in this situation, that if we can collaborate, the different security companies, if they can collaborate with each other in the specific areas, they actually assist groups like SAPS and Metro and Flying Squad to actually assist them in combating the specific, crime, if it is ours, robberies or hijackings or things like that, and allows them, if they work together, to actually, solve that specific issue or problem when it happens. Because a lot of the time, there's only one specific vehicle that comes across a situation or a hijacking, and they always need backup. But we're in a position that we can't just rely on SAPS anymore to be there in a timely fashion, because they are flooded. So the security companies actually don't mind working together and to help each other out. It's just a way of opening communication channels, because everybody's got more work than they know what to do with. But there's no time really for these security companies to go to other companies in their neighborhoods and then start discussions about something like this, because there's been no formal agreement like this before. And a lot of the companies we see already help each other. They're on the same radio channels, they're on the same communication networks on WhatsApp. So the idea was just to actually structure something a bit better. And we're going to roll it out in Pretoria and then obviously from there into the wider Gauteng areas, and then see how wide we can actually roll it out countrywide.
I suspect this is either a very stupid or a very obvious question, but why focus specifically on those hours between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m.?
Yeah, like you said, very obvious. The crime during those hours spike. There's still a lot of crime that happens during the day, but there's a lot more responders available during the day. So when crime happens during daylight hours, there's a lot more law enforcement available to respond. Whereas at night, we've seen, it's a lot quieter and the people actually need backup. So in our situation, we supply products for the tactical equipment market, and a big majority of that is tactical flashlights. So for us, it just made sense to obviously, get better equipment through to the law enforcement officers. But then we quickly realized, these guys are not communicating with each other. There's definitely an opportunity or a gap in the structure to actually try and combat crime just a bit more effectively. So, nighttime hours is obviously probably some of the most dangerous periods.
Yeah. Well, obviously,
the type of crime that
sure. That does make sense. What role will communities, Werner, and neighborhood watchers play in this new framework?
Yeah, so groups like the CPF and similar entities across South Africa play an enormous part in crime prevention at the moment. It is something that probably every community that you go to in South Africa will have a WhatsApp group between the different entities, between the CPF and SAPS and the local security companies. And that's sort of become the norm for South Africa. So it's small hubs that take care of themselves. So in this case, we work very closely with groups like the CPF and the local community, like safety sectors. And I personally think it's just going to increase. People are relying on themselves, so groups tend to form, the communities take care of themselves, and it's small hubs that lock into bigger hubs. So that's a vital part of it. There's no question about it. It starts on the ground, it starts on the community, then it goes up to the private security sector, and then from there on it goes to the official law enforcement entities like SAPS.
Werner van der Westhuizen, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, here's a surprise in a tough economy. South Africa's toy market, worth more than 9.6 billion rand, is still growing, I'm told. Despite higher import costs and shrinking household budgets, families are finding new ways to keep play alive. They're focusing on durability, value, and creativity over luxury. Interesting to read as well that online sales are booming. I guess no surprise there. Mid-range toys are leading growth, and the sector could double by 2033. So let's explain how the business of play is defying economic gravity. I'm joined by Glenn Ambrose, country manager for the global toy maker Zuru. Glenn, in an economy, and welcome to you, as strained as we are in this country, how is the toy market still growing when we see so many categories shrinking?
So it does sound a little bit counterintuitive, but it does seem to be the case in toy. I think it's the fact that when budgets are quite tight, parents still want to find a way to treat their children, and will look for affordable ways to do so. So even though we're seeing decreases in certain segments in toy, we're seeing a decent increase in the value sector. So we've seen about 6% growth all over the whole market, and it's driven by value-seeking consumers. So they're buying more durable, affordable toys with a bit longer playtime and lifetime.
In many ways, it's like that old economic adage that in tough times, lipstick sales never really diminish.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's always going to be evergreen items that people are going to continue to purchase and try and make sure that they've got in their household.
So emotional value, Glenn, is one thing, but I guess that there's also a focus these days on smarter retail and more strategic and smarter pricing.
Definitely, yeah. So, I mean, parents are doing what everyone else is doing in the market. They're trading down, but they don't want to compromise on quality. So they're looking for decent valued items between the 100 and 500 Rand marks, and that's where the sales are being driven.
So you talk about value-driven families. Glenn, what exactly does that mean in how people choose toys, whether they're going online or walking into a store? What kind of behavioral changes are we able to detect here?
Yeah, so obviously the world has got a lot smaller with online, so everyone can jump online and compare items from a number of different retailers quite easily. So people are being a little bit smarter. They're looking to do a little bit of a better purchase with their money. So instead of getting something that's big and flashy and complicated and could be broken in a week or two, they're looking for something that might be able to be handed down to another child or shared with a sibling or even with the whole family to play with.
And that means more tactical and probably cleverer marketing and promotions from the toy manufacturers themselves.
Definitely, as well as the promotions, it's also about how the toys are produced. So making sure that we're producing those type of items, that parents can see the value quite easily. They're not wondering about what the product does. It's in their face. And there's a lot of online marketing to support that, to give the kids and the parents as much information as possible. So when they go into a toy store, or if they're on the line, they actually know what they're looking for. And they're not just wandering around aimlessly.
And just how big a role then has online shopping played in keeping this category not only alive, but in many respects booming?
Yeah, it's played a huge part, and it's vital especially for toys, but I mean for all sectors. I mean, the sales are expected to hit 1.6 billion this year, which is more than 20% up year on year. So parents are obviously loving the convenience, the ability to be able to compare, like I just said, and then also to find those limited edition items. So maybe an item that isn't in every toy store, online retailers can hold those more niche items.
Well, let me push you a little bit on that. I understand the value for money debate, and it makes perfect sense in this economy. But I'm wondering if there's still a market for premium high-end toys, or are you starting to see that segment slowly disappearing?
No, I don't think it's disappearing. It's just become a little bit more selective. So parents are definitely willing to pay for something that is that innovative or maybe is top of the child's list. But they just want to make sure that it's going to last an item. So like if it's an X-Shot item, our quality blasters that can be passed around and played with all their friends, and you know that last the test of time. Or a building set from Max that kids can interact with over and over again. They're willing to put the money into that. I think what's disappearing is the impulse premium, the more expensive gimmicky items that just don't offer the value for money.
So you've mentioned a couple of toys. Are there specific products that are winning right now? What's flying off the shelves as we start to hit the Christmas season?
So collectibles are doing very well, and construction. Those are sort of the clear standouts. Mini brands, we've had really good success this year with our mini brands collectibles. Fill the Fridge in particular, that's available at Toys R Us, is doing extremely well. And then our Max Premium that we launched last year has also got into the construction category, which is a very difficult category to breach, and we're doing very well. The other collectibles that we've seen do really nicely are our plush items, so Snackles and Fugglers, that are collectible items that have different themes constantly being introduced. People are really investing in those.
And just
they also hit a bit of a sweet spot of being affordable, but can also be collected and, you know, are fun and interactive.
And just a final one, a lot of our toy supply does come from China. How difficult is it to balance affordability with rising shipping and import costs?
It definitely had an effect on us. So the volatility of Forex is really difficult. It's difficult to obviously keep constant pricing when our currency is going up and down and everything is actually purchased originally in dollars. And logistics was extreme last year. It has improved a bit this year. So we're seeing a little bit of a respite there, but it definitely has an effect. I mean, especially in our economy, like I said, where things can change suddenly and we're such a price-sensitive market, it does have a negative effect. We're not in such a bad shape at the moment, to be honest, though.
Glenn Ambrose, thank you very much indeed. Country Manager for the global toy maker Zuru, I do appreciate your time. And that is our program for today and also for the week. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.